Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today I'm playing an interview with jazz singer and lyricist Mark Winkler. And for your listening enjoyment, I'm playing several songs from various albums of Mark's. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
The Lynn Show is all about recognizing that most of us are hiding parts of ourselves, hiding things that we are or can do or think or feel, ways that we naturally are reflexes. And we're hiding them not just from other people the way, you know, you keep secrets because, well, maybe you have a way of being in the world that you're a little embarrassed about and you don't let people know that. But in addition to those things, there are things that we are hiding even from ourselves. Ways that we can be. Actions that we would take spontaneously, which we learned so early in life to first to pretend that we weren't, because it didn't somehow fit with our childhood. And then we got so good at pretending that we forgot altogether that we could be that, do that, have that way of being in the world. Often people find this very difficult to believe. How could I be keeping secrets about myself from myself? But I'm a psychotherapist, and I see it over and over and over. I see people who are hyper-responsible. They never let any responsibility go undealt with. They write those Christmas and birthday cards long before, or maybe they even have a storehouse. You know people who have that? They have a box or a shelf or a closet, right, that has cards for every occasion. And so they're never at a loss. And then they've got on their calendar, if they're still using calendars, or in their palm or their BlackBerry or wherever they keep this such information. Or maybe it's just that Facebook or LinkedIn or one of them tells them this, oh, the birthday is coming up, and they've got those cards written, you know, way in advance. They always have the party at their house. They're always so busy that they never have a good time. And they don't realize that inside of themselves is a person who doesn't care that much about this stuff, who could be haphazard, who could be irresponsible, who could just have a good time. And quite often these people wind up in my office because they burn out. They are exhausted. They are overwhelmed. They are ill. And recognizing that the capacity to be less diligent, less vigilant, less in control, and more relaxed, more spontaneous, more silly, is a surprise to them, because they learned early in their life, sometimes very, very early in a life, that to be spontaneous, to be frivolous, to be silly, to let a responsibility go uncared for was to court embarrassment, teasing, punishment, disaster. So many children who are the children of divorce or have a parent go off to fight in a war or, God forbid, die, make the decision, and I know you know this because it's become common knowledge, that the parent left because they were not good enough. And so they make this decision quite young, 2, 4, 7, 8, that they from now on will be perfect. They will do it all right. Never again will they run the risk of losing a loved one because they were not perfect. And so the challenge to always do it right, to be there first, never to let anything go by, becomes what I call their cover story. Their cover story is, I'm good. I do what needs to be done. And undercover is a child yearning to breathe free, to mix a metaphor, yearning to play in the sunshine, yearning not to have to worry if the table isn't set perfectly or if the house isn't clean or if such and such didn't get their birthday gift on time. And it is that part of them that they need so that they can live. Sometimes so that they can live, but always so that they can live a happier, more free life, a life that is more the life they would have lived had this unfortunate event not occurred in them. A life. So it is my job, and it is the job of this show, to point out that everybody listening, that's me included, may very well have parts of ourselves from which we are shielded, walled off. And that quite often those parts of ourselves are precisely the ones that we badly need to live the life that we were meant to live happy, to live free, to live as good and pleasant and delightful a life as we can. To this end, I not only talk about this, talk about why we have to hide parts of ourselves, how we can reclaim these parts of ourselves, but I also interview people who make a living or a life with an art. I do this because these people are people who are, at least in the area of their work, exactly who they really are. To use the psychotherapeutic term, they are synchronistic. They are in sync with themselves. And you can hear it in all these interviews. And today, I'm playing an interview with Mark Winkler, who is a lyricist and sometime complete songwriter and singer. And you hear in Mark, he was always a singer. He says he was always a singer, even when his family, all of whom were musicians and singers, said, don't you sing, you're the baby, we don't need to have your voice. But he always knew that music was his thing. And it's not an easy life. You hear it in all the artists that I talk to. But those of us who are captured by an art early on face the dilemmas, endure the challenges, because it is who we are. And you hear it in Mark. In addition to this interview, I'm going to play two songs. The first song is called Lonely Woman, and it's from Mark's CD, Easy the Hard Way. It's a jazz CD, and this song was written by great jazz musician Horace Silver and Leonard Feather, who, if you know, wrote a column in which he talked about jazz and music for many, 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 many years, and wrote a few songs, this being one of them. At the end of the show, right before we sign off, I'm playing a song called Sissies, which Mark wrote, and it's in a CD of his called Till I Get It Right, and Mark talks about it in the interview, so you'll hear that. Well, all right, I think I'm just going to play Lonely Woman, and that will be followed immediately by my interview with Mark. Here it is.
In one room, deep gloom, sheltering her from joy she once knew. There sits a lonely woman, believing her life is through. Though she once lived for laughter, days bring no spring. Winter is here to stay for a while. Too drained of tears for crying, she's too alone to smile. Longing for her lover, wish that I could tell her. Grieving too can pass, and so this mood will soon lift like a veil. Then some day she'll stray far from the somber world of the past. No more lonely woman, she'll follow the sun at last. So this mood will soon lift like a veil. Then someday she'll stray far from the somber world of the past. No more alone. she'll follow the sun at last. No more a lonely woman, she'll follow the sun.
I'm here with Mark Winkler in his wonderful studio in West Hollywood. And Mark doesn't know anything about what I do, so I'm going to tell him.
Great.
Okay. I have an internet radio show, mm-hmm. and for it, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this is true for you.
Very true.
Very true. And I ask them all the exact same question, mm-hmm. and that is, how did it happen? How did it find you? How did it occur to you? How did it capture you? When did it start? I know that sounds like a lot of questions, but it's really only one.
No, it seems pretty simple for me. I grew up in a family where everybody was a singer.
Aha!
So I didn't have much of a choice, really. My mom was a big band singer.
Wow.
And my father wanted to be an opera singer, but didn't do it. Didn't
because?
I don't really know. I don't think his need to do it was that strong, to be honest.
Did he talk about it? Did he say, oh, damn, I want to, I didn't?
No, he would just tell me, oh, I wanted to be an opera singer when I was a young man. But,
when he was a young man, but then he did other stuff. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, right, okay.
He was also going to be a rabbi, because my grandfather was a famous rabbi in Los Angeles. So he was going to be the son who was going to be the rabbi, and then he gave all that up and became he sold watches.
Wow.
At the movie studios. 20th and
wow.
20th Century Fox, he sold watches.
Okay, so did you get the sense? Well, no, don't let me get ahead of myself. So, do you have siblings who sang as well?
Yeah, I had one brother, my middle brother. I'm the youngest. And he sang, and our whole family would get together, and everybody would sing.
Would sing.
And to be honest, they wouldn't let me sing, because there was too many people singing. And I don't think until my voice changed that I sang good.
Well enough
to be a family get-together. My mother played piano, and everybody would sing. So, but that didn't make me want to be a singer. I wanted to be a singer, you know, from the minute, you know, I loved music. And I loved singing, and I wrote songs when I was a young kid.
Really?
Really bad songs. Really bad songs.
How do you know?
Because now, as an adult, I'm not going to sing it. I still remember some of them.
Oh, yeah, do.
Oh, no, I'm not.
No. You're so cute. He's blushing. I just wanted to say this is radio, and he can't.
Oh, gosh. But anyway, I remember
we won't hold it against you.
When I was about 9 years old, I told my parents I was going to be a singer. Like it was some shameful thing.
Wow.
And my mom and dad went, yeah, sure. Like, of course, you know, of course you're going to be a singer. But,
Do you think that they thought that that meant career? I mean, one can say to a 9-year-old, of course, honey, you're going to be a singer, without really anticipating that you're going to give your life to it.
Well, my mother had been a professional singer.
Right, right.
So she knew. You know, and she talked to us about it, you know, the life, you know, being on the road and the crazy musicians and the breaks that didn't quite happen and all that stuff. So, you know, I had some reality because she had been a professional. But I think she knew for me, there were three sons, and I was the best scholastically. So she always figured that no matter what I decided to do, I'd have a job.
Right. That you could survive, that you could take care of yourself.
Yeah, she knew that.
And clearly it was true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Right.
That's true.
So,
it's a tough life.
So, yeah. So now, okay, nine. Mm-hmm. Then what happened?
I started singing. And when I was in high school, I met my aunt, who was also a singer. My mom's sister had been a singer in the 50s. And she heard me singing at one of the family dues and said, you're really good. I'm going to introduce you to this guy that played accordion in the band I was with. And now he's a big arranger. And his name was Jimmy Haskell. Do you know Jimmy Haskell?
I know who he is, okay.
And this was 1967.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I want you to meet him. And the funny story is, Jimmy had just separated with his wife. My aunt was a beautiful woman. And he didn't really care about me at the beginning. He just wanted to date my aunt. And my aunt said, okay, if you see my nephew, I'll date you.
Oh, cute. Very cute. That's good for her.
Yeah. So that didn't go anywhere. But
Jimmy and
my aunt.
Right.
But Jimmy actually and I really got along great. And he was the first person to say to me, do you write songs? And I said, I do, but not really. But that night I started writing songs. And from that minute on, I wrote songs.
Wow.
I had a dream. I wrote this terrible song in my dream. I sang it for him. And that started, he produced some demos, and that started me on it.
Okay, so what happened?
You want me to go to the whole?
I do.
It really quickly.
Yeah. Well, hit the high points.
The high points. What happened is I was writing. I was playing piano. You know, it was the singer-songwriter.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Did you learn to play piano?
At a very late stage. I'm not a very good piano player, but I did learn to play the piano in the 70s. And I was writing my own songs. And I went to see a music publisher. And he said to me, basically, who do you think you write like? And I said, I think I write like Randy Newman. And he said, I don't think so. You're not as good as Randy Newman. He said, I think you've got something, but you need to go and take some songwriting lessons. And I felt really bad and crushed and all that. And then I thought about it, huh? Maybe he's right. And I started taking songwriting classes with Al Kasha, mm-hmm. who had written The Morning After.
Yeah, I know what it means.
Yeah. And he was a great songwriting teacher. And I met lots of friends that have been friends of mine for the rest of my life in this class. And I learned the basics of songwriting. And it really helped me. And I started writing songs. Then I wrote the song. I had like six songs. And I'd go around to publishers. And I'd play my five songs, and they'd go, yeah, and they'd be on the phone, they'd be chewing gum. And then I'd sing this one song, and they'd stop,
wow.
like a dead stop. And I'd finish, and they'd go, that's good. And one day, I was in my little apartment in Hollywood, my little cracker box apartment, and Helen Reddy calls me up, you know, and says, did you write Tropical Nights? And I said, yeah. And she says, well, your publisher showed it to me, and we're going to record it. And at the time, Helen Reddy was the number one female singer.
Oh, my God.
And she said, here's my producer. I forgot what his name was. And we're going to record it next week. I just love the song. And here am I in my little apartment thinking, oh, my God, this is, I've made it.
I'm home, right.
Okay, next week, the following week comes, don't hear from her. The following week comes, I look in Variety. She's broken up with her producer. So I learned something. So she never recorded it, but Liza Minnelli wound up recording, and it was
wow.
the title of one of her CDs, albums in those days. And, you know, because it was Liza Minnelli, it was, you know, I got a lot of mileage out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started writing songs. I began writing songs for different people and did the publisher's thing and did that for many years. And then I got into singing, jazz. I this wedding band I was singing with, was a jazz band when they weren't playing all the wedding songs.
Right.
And I used to come to their rehearsal before the wedding band rehearsal and listen to all the jazz songs. And I thought, wow, I love this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started singing jazz. And I met a guy who was with a little label, and he signed me. And I did my first album in 1982.
Wow.
Yeah. And the album actually did pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And it became a big hit in Japan. And
That's a big place for American jazz, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a big market. You know, they always say it's not necessarily that it's such a big place for a jazz, but that it's a big music market and that, you know...
Lots of things have an opportunity
yeah.
to happen there.
Yeah, lots of things have an opportunity. So I did well in Japan for a long time, and I've put out a lot of albums. And then, so I was doing that. I was writing songs for artists.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 10, 12 years ago, a friend of mine came to me and said, I'm writing a musical called Naked Boy Singing,
mm-hmm.
and I want you to write a song for it. And I said, sure.
Yeah.
And because I thought it was a great title, I said, that is a great title, you know. And, but then I thought to myself, what do I know about nudity? because I'm a Jewish guy, and I'm never naked. This is true, Lana. I'm never naked. But I thought to myself, okay, you know. And I wrote it, and it was a gigantic hit. It's the number 4th longest running off-Broadway show.
Oh, my God.
It's been playing for 11 years.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So that was lovely. I wrote 3 songs for that show, and it was lovely being associated with something so successful.
Yeah, right. And then didn't that sort of start you on another thing?
Yeah. I started writing musicals, and now I've written like 5.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Of your own? I mean...
I wrote 2 of mine that are completely, I wrote everything. One I conceived it, called Too Old for the Chorus, but Not Too Old to Be a Star, which is just being published by Samuel French.
Very nice.
And it's had a couple of, 3 major productions, you know, L.A., San Diego, and La Mirada. And then I wrote another musical about dogs called Bark. It's playing around the country. And I have another musical that just did the NAMP Festival in New York called Play It Cool, which is a jazz musical.
Mm.
So I went on that whole trajectory of writing musicals, which I love to do, but I'm still making my jazz CDs. Then I became an educator.
Wow.
So
you figured, I know all this stuff, I ought to give it away?
Well, it wasn't quite like that. This is the true story is,
yeah,
I was having a very frustrating time on one of my musicals with my collaborators, no names mentioned. And I said, I've got to do something to get my mind off this because it's driving me crazy. You know, they were sabotaging it and we were disagreeing, and it was really sort of like driving me nuts. So I thought, you know, I'm gonna teach. You know, I've always wanted to teach. I like the idea of teaching, and that's what caused me to start teaching.
So talk about what you decided to teach.
Lyric writing, because I'm a lyricist.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I decided I would do. And the first thing I did is I read about 14 books on songwriting. And I realized most of them weren't really good.
Yeah.
There are a couple that are really good. The Sheila Davis book is really good.
She's a wonderful person.
Yeah. Is she wonderful? Well, yeah. She's
a wonderful person.
of all the books, I like that one the best. And there's another one, Jason Blum, who's a Nashville songwriter. And I was reading his book and going, wow, I really agree with this guy. He's right. And then at the end he says, oh, I learned all I learned everything I knew about songwriting from Al Kasha. I said, oh, okay. So that's why I agree with him. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I started teaching, and now I teach at UCLA Extension, and I do private lessons and all that stuff.
And it's
in
all
my spare time.
Wow. Okay. All right. So.
So I have 5 careers.
Yes, you do. But they all have a core.
Mm-hmm.
They have the base, and that is music.
Right.
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 Right. Right. It's wonderful. Okay. So I always ask the same question.
Yeah.
And that is, it's a philosophical question, really. It's having given an entire life to the pursuit of this art,
mm-hmm,
what do you want to say about that? What do you think about that? What philosophical position do you have about it? What remains, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I feel about it is, and what I've learned, you know, what I've learned over the years is that the doing of it, the writing of the song, the doing the concerts, the teaching the students is the great joy of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the successes that come along occasionally are nice, but that really isn't worth devoting your life to it. That what's made my life full, and I think very well spent, is the great joy I've had,
mm-hmm,
in the doing.
Great.
You know,
yeah.
And, you know, and just the wonderful little things that come along occasionally. I wrote a song on my last record about Truman Capote called Sissies. And I sang it last Friday night. And I stopped doing it for a couple of months because I'd done it so much. And so I put it back in the show. And this woman comes up to me at the end of the show. And she says to me, I wish my brother could have heard this song.
Oh,
he killed
goodness.
Himself in the 80s because he was so ashamed of being gay. And I'm gay, and I don't make any bones about it. And I wish he could have heard this song.
Oh.
I think his life would have changed. And she was completely taken by the song. And that meant so much to me.
I'll bet.
You
I'll
know.
Bet.
And then another wonderful thing that happened was when I was a little kid, I lived at the Garden of Allah Hotel. Do you know this hotel?
I do.
It's this famous Hollywood hotel
mm-hmm.
that was owned by Rudolph Valentino's first wife.
Not Betta Bera.
Naza. I'm sure your listeners will all be going with those.
Yeah, those.
Anyway,
right.
But she built it, and it was on its very last legs when my family was there. But we lived there for 3 months, and there was a cha-cha band. It played at that restaurant.
It's something that's very funny.
Yeah, and when I was a little boy of 8 years old, I thought it was the most glamorous thing I'd ever seen. Every night there'd be cha-cha music. And I wrote a song about it, and the guy, Manny Lopez, who headed up the cha-cha band, little thinking that, I wrote the song, and then I had this friend who was like this detective. He finds Manny Lopez. And Manny Lopez is this guy who was sort of going to be the new Perez Prado. But he never quite made it.
Mm-hmm.
So for Manny's 80th birthday party, or maybe it was his 70th birthday party, I sang the song to Manny in front of his whole family.
Oh, my God.
And it was such a fantastic moment. I couldn't have wished for a more wonderful moment. I mean, Manny, it was so wonderful. He loves the song, and the family loves it. And that was just a wonderful moment for me.
So you're talking about the impact that
yes.
this has. It seems to me you're saying two different things. One of them is that the work itself
mm-hmm.
is enough.
Yeah.
And then, if you're lucky enough to see that it has impact on people, that is...
Oh, that's just wonderful.
It's gravy. I mean, it's whipped cream, right?
Yeah.
And then, if you have an occasional success, mazel tov, you know?
Yeah, like, all of a sudden, I wrote the song with David Benoit 20 years ago called Land of the Loving, and I was trolling through YouTube, and I think I put in David Benoit first, and then all of a sudden, I saw all of our Land of the Loving. Every female singer in the Philippines had recorded it. Who knew? So I found out that it became the tourism song of the Philippines that year. And I made quite a bit of money. I mean, that was just like...
Right, right.
Who knew?
Yay!
Who knew? Yay!
right.
So these things happen. But you get better and you work with wonderful people. I've worked with fantastic people mm-hmm. in the music business. Musicians that have been the great joy, the level of musicians.
This is all about joy, it seems to me.
Yeah, I try, and if it isn't, if I start being around people and they're about being bitter and about being resentful and about being on drugs or whatever, I just cut them loose really fast now.
Mm-hmm.
My
Are you saying that you didn't used to?
Right. When I was young and stupid, I remember one musician came up to me and went, I'm an alcoholic and I love it. I don't mind it. And now I realize that people tell you who they are
right.
pretty quickly.
Right.
And I went, no, you're not. Like I was 25.
Right.
No, you're not. Believe me, he was. I did a tour with him in Japan. He was an alcoholic.
And he warned you.
He warned me. Most people do.
Yes, they do.
They really do. Most people say who they are in some
right.
way or the other.
Right. And I think that's another interesting, but that's just a part of maturity. I mean, that could happen mm-hmm. to you even if you're not
in
alcoholic.
In working with people in a company.
Right. Okay, so... You haven't said any downside to this.
Oh, yeah. I can talk about the downside.
Would you like to?
Yeah.
Good.
The musicians I've worked with in show business are fantastic. But the business side of show business isn't fantastic. And I'm always, when people are always coming to me in Los Angeles, everybody who has a kid wants to put their kid in show business.
Yeah.
That's just a cliche, but it's pretty true.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always saying to them, don't do that. Show business is really tough. And it gives people a license to act really badly to other people. And I've encountered people that really treated me very badly. Have for no reason other than...
Your talent.
Yeah, whatever.
And talent is what? Expendable? I don't know. Do you know what I mean?
No. I sort of lost the thread.
Oh, well, maybe I'm wrong about this, but in...
I mean, they treated me badly because of my talent.
Yeah.
No, I think they just treat you badly because show business gives them license to treat people badly.
Do you know where that comes from? I mean...
Well, you know, there's no... You know, I worked a day job for many years. I had a day gig for 18 years. Luckily, I gave it up in 2000. And at least for my gig in market research, the people who were the bosses
right.
went to college and got a degree and had some sort of skills.
Right.
But in show business, you can get to the level of being head of publishing or a manager or definitely a club owner and not have any skills.
Right.
And I've met a lot of wonderful club owners, but I'd say as a rule, they're pretty crazy. And I try to keep my distance and, you know, keep my eyes open. So
well, what I meant when I said talent is that's a...
Oh,
that's,
people just resent you because you have talent.
Well, that, but also...
Yeah, that's true.
Also, like in TV,
mm-hmm.
You know, there's plenty of talent.
Yeah.
You know, they don't... You know, you're good, but someone else will be good,
yeah.
so they don't have to take care of you.
That's right.
And there are lots of people standing behind you wanting your spot.
That's right.
You know, so there's that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of people. I had an incredible conversation with Janice Page before mm-hmm. she died. And she said when she started on Broadway that there wasn't as many people vying for the roles.
Right.
That it just wasn't a celebrity
obsessed culture.
Oh, no,
it's changed. It's absolutely changed.
And she said that nowadays the level of talent is so big.
Extraordinary. And the competition.
How deep it is. And I had never thought about that. She says, in my day, there just wasn't that many people.
Right. You know, I heard the same thing from Betty Garrett.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Oh, interesting.
You know?
Because the same era.
It's the same era. And it is true. I think it's true. They're just now...
You look a little like Betty Garrett.
Okay.
I mean, a young Betty Garrett.
Yeah, right.
Betty Garrett looks pretty great.
Oh, she's amazing.
Well, I love people who have long...
Oh, my God. Talk about a life of...
A life.
A life in the
career.
Yeah, right.
And ups and downs.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You can listen to her interviews.
Oh, good.
It's quite amazing. Yeah.
Good.
But she said the same thing, that the business has changed so much. And you know, it's not only... Ironically, it's not only show business. Pretty much everything. There are more of us trying to do everything.
Right.
So there's more competition for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And my own feeling about the arts is that people have mixed feelings about artists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we love to sing the songs and, you know, watch people act, but we don't have a lot of regard for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we think, we still call it playing and, mm-hmm. you know, and... you are still liable to hear, oh, you're a songwriter? Well, yeah, well, what do you do for a living?
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And it can be very difficult in that sense, that the people don't have a lot of, well, regard.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard work.
Yeah. Everybody thinks they can write a song.
And that's the other thing.
And everybody right. has written a song.
Yes.
So that I find very unique. When I teach... My kids at UCLA, and they always ask me, well, how long is it going to be, you know, before I write a good song? And I go, well, you might get lucky and write a good song pretty quickly, but to be a consistently good songwriter, it's going to take between 5 and 7 years. And they look at me like I'm crazy.
Yeah.
Because the idea of, like, 5 and 7 years, that's like a lifetime to them, you know.
Right.
And they, you know, and I talk to people that I teach songwriting, and most people say, well, what do you have to teach?
Yeah, right.
Because, you know... Showbiz, you know, there people, you know, people see, you know, movies about the
yes.
business. Somebody sings a song, they give them a standing ovation. The next minute, they're
a star. Right, right.
Yeah, and you know, are they? I remember there was a stupid movie with Drew Barrymore called Words and Music. She's like a lyricist.
Yeah, right. She's a maid.
She's a maid. Right.
Right.
She's writing poetry in a little
right,
notebook.
Right.
And the next minute, she's writing these great, or anyway, professional songs.
Right.
And it's like. Nothing, you know.
Right.
So, yeah, so people are brought up with that stereotype or that fallacy.
The other thing that occurs to me that hadn't occurred to me until just now is that not only for songwriters and for singers and for actors, if you really do it well, it looks easy.
Yeah.
And that's a confusing. It's not easy.
It's not easy.
It's not easy, but it looks easy if you...
Yeah.
If you're good at it. You know?
Yeah.
So people don't necessarily see what it took.
Yeah.
You know?
But I used to work in a publisher's office and used to get songs, and there's some, you know, honestly, 99% of them were just awful, god-awful.
Yes.
And this idea of everybody has talent and every, you know, it's like, hello.
Hello.
But anyway, so, yeah, you're competing with, and the internet has made it even harder, and computers and our society, because now everybody can get on YouTube.
Right.
Everybody can post their song on Facebook. And I say to the kids who take my classes, it's really tempting to post your new video and your newest song, but have that network of people around you who are going to tell you, hey, it's good, post it.
Or not.
Yeah, because what can happen, I went to a mixer last night with NARIS, the Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences, and I met a girl, very nice. She said, oh, I'm a songwriter, singer, and go to my website and you'll see my, you know, my videos and everything. And she was really nice, and I go to her website and I see her video. I see one of her videos, and it lasted about 20 seconds. And I went, wow, she's really bad.
Mm.
So, I mean, so if, you know, and the next time that girl comes to me, it's going to, would take a lot for me to watch it again.
Right.
So maybe she would, if she...
Maybe even if she has something wonderful, you wouldn't see it.
Right.
Right.
Because I'd go, you know, she's not really good.
Right.
So people do themselves a real disservice by not getting their work vetted.
Yeah.
And I say to people, I go, don't listen to if your mom likes it. Don't, you know, if she likes it, if she doesn't like it, don't listen. You need to get professionals around you and pay them. Take them out to lunch and ask them, because you're going to do yourself a big disservice if you're... Get it, you know, you can get in to see a lot of people. People will click on a video. But if they don't like it, you'll never get in to see them again.
That is wonderful advice.
Yeah, because the world has gotten to that point. It's like all automatic.
Well, and it's that 30-second soundbite thing. You know, that's what you got.
Yeah.
You know, I remember that when you were talking about, you know, taking stuff to a publisher and they're on the phone and they're chewing gum. And you can see it, you know. They don't. You don't get them in the first, you know,
oh,
they're
yeah.
not there.
Don't
you know.
Bore us. Get to the
get
chorus.
Get to it. That's it.
Don't bore us. Get to the chorus. Yeah.
I never heard that.
Oh, you never heard that? Oh, yeah.
No.
But I did that whole publisher life where, you know, you had really 30 seconds.
Right. Exactly.
Capture them.
Yeah.
And they go, okay, what do you have? What else?
What else? Play the next
one.
Right.
So you go through six songs, you know,
right.
like in
yes,
2 minutes.
I know that one.
But, it, you know, it's a very... It's very humbling, and it's, you know, you got to get good. You know, you don't want that pain, you know. You want to get better. And you learn a lot, and you find the ones that are nurturing and nice, and you work with them.
Well, and also that hear you. Not everybody hears you,
You know, when I started taking lessons with Al Kasha, I wasn't very good. I mean, I'm just saying that. I'm not being humble. But he liked me from the beginning. And I've thought about it and thought about it and thought about it. And now that I'm a teacher, I realize why he was nice to me. And it's because I didn't have any craft, but I had interesting ideas.
Right.
And that, to a teacher, is more interesting. Because you can get craft.
Right.
Everybody can learn craft.
Right.
But what everybody can't learn is having something to say. That's what people can't learn.
And that, it seems to me, is what makes the difference. I mean, you have people saying the same thing over and over and over and over again. It's, who cares?
Yeah. You know, in the same way.
Right.
And I was talking to a DJ on K-Jazz in L.A. And I don't know how we started talking about it. Because I do this class called How to Make Your Own CD and Not Go Broke.
Uh-huh.
I also teach this class. And one of the things I... And it's basically the jazz singers. And I say to them, okay, if you're going to do a jazz standard, don't do it exactly like everybody else has done it.
Right.
Because if you're going to be doing All of Me, you can go on iTunes and see that Frank Sinatra's done it, Ella Fitzgerald's done it, Sarah Vaughan's done it, Louis Armstrong's done it, and they've all done it really well.
Right.
So if you're going to do that song...
You had better have a new take on that song.
A new take on it. And this guy was saying to me, he said 80% of the vocal CDs I get, they're doing the same jazz songs like the greats did it, but just not as good.
Right.
And he said,
who cares?
So you gotta find your own take. What do you have to say?
But isn't it the same thing over and over that you have to be yourself, not someone else, whatever that is?
Yeah.
I think that's very difficult for people.
It's difficult for some people.
And then for others, they can't help it.
Yeah, they can't help it. Some people, the part that's difficult is when you're writing songs, you're bearing your soul.
That's right.
And there's a lot of people that just don't have that connection with their emotions. They don't have that line there yet. They're afraid of it. They're hiding it. They're putting it aside. They don't want to deal with it. So they don't have that access.
No, that's right.
So, you know, it's not an easy thing to
expose yourself.
About, to expose yourself and talk about what really means something to you. So, you know, but some people just do.
Yes,
you know, just
right.
Some people, and I try to give people exercises that get them in touch. But some people just, no matter what I do, they'll just avoid
well,
it.
You know, I'm a psychotherapist, so you know, you're preaching to the converted here.
Yeah, but yeah, I had this girl in my class, not the last class, but the class before, and she would not write about her feelings. And I said to her, what do you feel strongly about? And she said, well, I hated my father. She said, you know, he really didn't like what I was doing. And I said,
well, that's a prolific vein right there.
Yeah, but she didn't want to get near her feelings. I mean, she really, I couldn't. I became her father. I mean, I think any guy became basically her
right.
father. And so she didn't like forms. She was one of these people I'd go, you know, okay, here are the forms. And she'd go,
right.
Why? Why
do
I?
And
I'd go, you know. So
yeah, but if you're not going to be, you know, Leonard Cohen, you know.
Right. You know, I mean, and I'm sure, and I am sure, he knows the forms.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
He
exactly
breaks
right.
them, but he sure knows them.
Right.
So I say there's a really, I always say that when I went to Europe and I went to, there's a Picasso museum, I forgot where, not in Paris, there is. There's one when he was a young child that has all of his art, when he was like 5, 6, 7.
Wow.
And he was the greatest figurative artist I've ever seen. I mean, he made things that looked like pictures. Mm-hmm. I mean, he knew the human anatomy.
Right.
He was so good at 7 that his father, who was an artist, said, I'm never going to draw again because he draws so much better than me.
My God.
And so he knew how to draw.
Right.
Realistic.
Before he started making...
Right. He had nowhere to go. I mean, he drew beautifully. I mean, his stuff is gorgeous. He had nowhere to go. He had to go in new directions, you know.
Right.
So I can always tell. What surprises me as a teacher is how quickly I know if people grasp
if they
form
it.
Or not. You know, grasp the techniques. You know, I know it like almost in 20 seconds.
Well, that, and you know whether they have access to their feelings, and you know whether they have ideas.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you
that's
know.
All pretty quick.
Right, right. And I think what you said is the truth, that as a teacher you would want to focus on those who have those things.
Yeah. And sometimes the wildest people, you know, there was this accountant in one of my classes, and he was the most fantastic writer, and he had no idea how good of a writer he was.
Wow.
And I think he's still an accountant, but he just wrote great stuff. And I kept saying, wow, this stuff's fantastic, you know.
So. All right, okay. So, anything to say about having given a life to the art of music?
Well, I think we've been talking about it. I am always amazed how hard it is to make a living at it.
Yeah.
That to me is like an interesting...
everybody says
corollary. You know, it's that I've gotten better at it. The business... You know, I think, you know, I'm an artist, so I'm not a businessman. So I'm not... I don't have my eye on the...
Ball.
Yeah,
right,
ball.
Right.
So that sort of goes hand in hand, but I've sort of gotten better at prioritizing and trying to concentrate on the stuff that fulfills me, but yet has the possibility of bringing him some money.
Yeah. But and then again, it's back to what you said when I first asked that question, and that is that you had better be getting joy from the thing.
Yeah.
Because there may be money, there may not be money. If you're not getting joy from the thing, then there's no... Then it's not worth doing.
It's not worth doing. Because there's a lot of, you know, like, there's a lot of unglamorous things about the business.
Yeah.
I mean, people think that it's, I find most of it not glamorous, but the thing I always find mystical and a joy and surprising is the creation, creating stuff.
The act of creation.
Yeah, that is fantastic. And I work with fantastic collaborators and musicians.
Yeah.
I'm just blessed to work with them. And that's just great.
And that, actually, I think that's a very good place to stop, with the idea that if you have that, if you have the capacity to create, mm-hmm. it's worth it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
That was great.
It went by in a blink of an eye.
So, a life dedicated to an art can be difficult. It can be problematic, challenging. But the ability to dip into, to use, to experience your own creativity is worth it. And this is what it sounds like when someone is speaking from their very self. You don't have to be a songwriter or a singer to experience the joy of dipping into your very self. Your very self is rewarding when you are it. But in the same way that living your life, dedicating it to an art, can be difficult or problematic, so can be being your very self. It's not always easily accepted. It's not always without challenges. In many of the shows, I have talked about the danger of discovering those aspects of yourself which you have had to hide. If you're curious about that, you can find those shows on my website. All of the shows are there in podcast. My website is thelynnshow.com, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E, don't leave out the E, S-H-O-W. I will continue to be talking about how we hide aspects of ourselves, how we can find them, how we can recover them, what gets between us and recovering them. I want to make that point very clearly because I don't want anybody to think that I think it's easy. It's not. Or at least it can be difficult. So I will be talking about that in future shows and continuing to do interviews with artists so that you can hear what it sounds like when somebody really is who they really are, like Mark. In a minute, I'm going to play the song he spoke about, Sissies, which had such a profound effect on at least one member of his audience, and my guess is on many, although they didn't all speak. But before I do that, I need to thank, as always, the indomitable Josh Hackney, without whom there would not be a show, and to tell you that if you need help with recording, engineering, computer, any of that, you want Josh, and you can get him by going up on my website as well, thelynnshow.com. And by saying that, I hope that you heard something that interested you in this show, something you can use, something that was of value to you, because I hope that it will bring you back, as I will be here next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too. And here now, Sissies.
He was he was famous. He put the out in the outrageous. He threw parties and took handsome men to bed. People laughed, he's a fairy. Little men can be quite scary. But looking back, he knew exactly who he was. Oh, the clothes that he wore, they don't make sissies like him anymore. He was swank, he drank whiskey. His voice was high, camp and lispy. He wore fancy suits with ascots round his neck. People whispered he's audacious, mixed his bobs with the salacious. But looking back, he was gay before it was cool. He would never bore. No, they don't make sissies like him anymore. He could make the ordinary extraordinary. He had a vision twice his size. The world says it loves the different, but the truth is that the different pay a price. He could write, he was brilliant, drink all night, be resilient, a grand confidant, famous friends galore. There will be no encore. No, they don't make sissies like him anymore. Now macho men are such bores, confusing strength with bravado. What lies beneath should be the motto, nothing more. No, they don't make sissies like him. They don't make sissies like him. They don't make homosexual, intellectual, frank and sexual sissy boys like Truman anymore.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. On singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, still got some tang, so